Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. There's been some positive development between First Nation communities and municipalities. Two researchers have found nearly 100 agreements have been signed between different First Nations and towns in BC. The agreements promote a number of different initiatives, from relationship building to jurisdictional and recognition of self-government and Aboriginal title. And a recently released Harvard Law School report has concluded mining regulations in BC have been and are unfair to First Nations in the province. The report urges the province to make changes and also makes recommendations to mining companies and First Nations alike. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has been moving ahead with its work after some reorganization and relocating its head office. Justice Murray Sinclair, chair of the TRC, gives Bombsida an update on the commission's activities. And there are many common threads in Indigenous art in Australia, New Zealand, and here in Canada. That's what Michelle Valley, assistant curator of the Mackenzie Art Gallery in Regina, noticed. She was part of a delegate of Aboriginal curators who attended the 17th Biennale in Sydney, Australia, with stops in New Zealand. And the Aboriginal People's Choice Awards is gearing up for its fifth event this fall. The awards competition is looking for submissions from artists and is also introducing a couple of new categories. All these stories plus great tunes, all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. The Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations doesn't think the proposed safe drinking water legislation goes far enough. FSIN Vice Chief Lyle Whitefish says the proposed legislation doesn't address the current lack of funding for First Nation drinking water infrastructure. He says the bill also places too much responsibility on First Nation chiefs and councils without providing adequate resources to meet the objectives of the new legislation. Currently across the country, there are 114 First Nations that are under drinking water advisories, and in Saskatchewan, there are 14 boil water advisories. Whitefish adds, First Nations pride themselves on having high water standards than other jurisdictions, and that's why communities want funding to develop legislation and standards that are acceptable for safe drinking water that ensures the health of First Nations citizens. The Haida Nation is receiving kudos from the World Wildlife Fund for its work to establish its own conservation area and Haida Heritage Site near the Queen Charlotte Islands. The Haida Nation tabled an amendment to the Canada National Marine Conservation Areas Act to formally establish the sites. The site will encompass about 3,400 square kilometers of ocean in the southern archipelago of Haida Gwaii. WWF says the landmark designation will set the stage for a new model of conservation, sustainable use, and integrated ecosystem management on BC's North Pacific coast. Once Parliament passes the amendment, the designation will become official. Following that, the Haida Nation in Canada will develop a management plan for the sites. A recently released Harvard Law School report has concluded that the mining regulations in BC are unfair to First Nations. The report, Bearing the Burden, The Effect of Mining on First Nations in British Columbia, is authored by Bonnie Doherty, an expert on international human rights law. Doherty says the Aboriginal consultation process should be improved.
We'd like to see a better balancing of burdens and benefits, and we think one way to do this, for example, is to improve the consultation process. So the government, we believe, should start consultation at the beginning of the mining process, you know, so at the free entry stage. It should continue to consult and give more adequate time for First Nations response throughout the process.
Doherty says the report also recommends more stringent environmental regulations, plus encourages mining companies to voluntarily consult Aboriginal communities and recommends First Nations to clearly outline how they want to be consulted. And First Nation leaders in BC are joining together to fight the looming harmonized sales tax. The Union of BC Chiefs has announced the Fight HST campaign, which will explore possible legal challenges to the 12% tax. Grand Chief Philip Stewart says the HST will have a huge impact on First Nations. He says the majority of First Nation people will struggle just to survive, and the tax will severely hurt them. Stewart also says the HST violates Aboriginal sovereignty over taxation for natives. Health Canada should improve its plan to fight tuberculosis and reduce the high rates of the diseases in First Nation and Inuit communities. That's according to a new report prepared by a federal health committee released earlier this week. The report also included many recommendations to revamp Canada's TB strategy amidst a renewed push to eliminate the disease. Committee members reported they were deeply concerned about the high rate of TB in First Nation and Inuit communities, which is 31 times higher than their mainstream counterparts. Public health experts and First Nation leaders say the report is a confirmation that the disease can no longer be ignored. Health Canada now has 2 to 3 months to respond to the report's recommendations. Next Alternative has acquired 90% of Keosan High Tech Company Limited and with it 13 patents. Keosan was established in 2000 and it's a leading researcher and manufacturer of technology and products that help in energy saving and producing a cleaner environment. Keosan's research team will continue to experiment within the realm of alternative energy and the future pending technical output, which will belong solely to Next Alternative. Robert Island, CEO of Next Alternative, says with the addition of Keosan's research, Next Alternative can cultivate an even more complete environment in which the fostering of further advancement can and will flourish. Cooperation between First Nation communities and municipalities is a good news story. That from Christopher Alcantara, a Wilfrid Laurier University researcher. Alcantara co-authored a research paper on the subject with University of Toronto postdoctoral candidate Jen Mells. Alcantara says the research focused in BC and found 93 different kinds of agreements. Those agreements included jurisdictional, relationship building, decolonization, and capacity building agreements. He says the most fascinating agreement was what he called decolonization agreements.
What's really interesting for us is what we call decolonization agreements. So we found actually 11 of these types of agreements in which the municipal government recognizes things like Aboriginal title, Aboriginal rights, that Aboriginal groups will have lived in the area and are on their lands time immemorial. Sometimes the recognition of Aboriginal self-government.
Alcantara says there are similar agreements in Ontario that have been signed. The Aboriginal People's Choice Awards are looking for submissions for its fifth annual event. Derek McCorrister is the manager of operations for the event, and he says the fairly new competition has been growing every year.
The word is getting out there. Yeah, we are relatively new. This is our fifth year. The awards have developed over the course of time. We've also introduced industry voters here as well, too. So industry professionals logging in and casting their vote in some of the industry categories.
McCorrister says the competition so far has averaged about 125 submissions every year, and this year there are already about 90, and he would like to see more. The deadline for submissions is June 30th. People can start voting online for their favorite artists by mid-July for the Aboriginal People's Music Choice Awards. The hardware will be handed out in November at the Manitowabi Festival in Winnipeg. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Have you ever watched the sunrise at the break of day? The light that's falling over scares the dark away. That's how it feels when I am with you.
Have you ever felt spring showers wash away the mud? The air is so much sweeter when the flowers to bloom. That's how it feels when I am with you.
You bring the light and brighten up my day. Wash away my
was Don Amaro with Sunshine and Rain, a cut from his album Deepening. Harvard Law School recently released a report that damns the mining industry in BC and indicates the government favors mining companies over the Aboriginal rights and title and the environment at the expense of human rights. The report is entitled Bearing the Burden, The Effects of Mining on First Nations in British Columbia. It was authored by Bonnie Doherty, who is also an expert on international human rights law and a lecturer with Harvard Law School's International Human Rights Clinic.
The report calls for legal reform of the mining regime, and we discussed that international and domestic law provides special protections for Aboriginal people. But in our research, we found that the current mining regime in British Columbia does not respect those protections and instead favors the mining regime. And what we would like to do is see that presumption set so that mining laws use Aboriginal rights basis and better balance the burdens and benefits that of mining across all the stakeholders, across government, industry, and First Nations people.
So what are some of the examples of mining favoritism?
One of the major examples is the system of free entry. And free entry means that almost anyone can come in and stake a claim on Crown land, and First Nations land is Crown land. The system recently turned into an online system. And so essentially anyone with a credit card and internet connection can stake a claim. However, when they do so, there's no requirement at that stage to consult the First Nations. So we argue that the consultation should begin at that early stage, because once the momentum of mining begins, it becomes harder and harder to stop it, even if there is indeed some consultation later in the process.
Okay, and you also focused on the Takla First Nation, and what are some of their specific issues in their territory?
They are particularly vulnerable to mining because they're in very mineral-rich soil. One of the biggest things they face is exploration. Exploration in and of itself, each individual site causes some destruction of the environment in terms of they have to make roads, they have to clear space for drill pads, but maybe isn't as destructive as a open pit mine, for example. However, the cumulative effects can cause significant damage, and there is limited consultation, more so than at the free entry stage. But in general, First Nations are given 30 days to respond to a proposal for an exploration, and that's just inadequate time for them to do an adequate research into determining the effects of the exploration. And on top of the lack of consultation, any destruction, disturbance of the wildlife or contamination of the water and so forth affects First Nations' way of life because the way of life is so intertwined with environmental health.
Did you get a chance to look at other provincial mining acts to compare the what's going on in BC?
No, we ended up focusing exclusively on BC. I know that free entry, for example, exists in other provinces, but we wanted to limit the scope of our research to make it more manageable. So we pretty much focused on British Columbia.
Okay, I understand. And why was Takla Lick First Nation chosen?
Well, we were interested. We'd heard about the free entry and projects on human rights in the environment or human rights in mining elsewhere in the world, and we heard about this free entry issue that seemed to raise human rights concerns. When we were talking to people about it, Takla Lick First Nation came up because of its vulnerability to mining, as I mentioned, because of its being on such mineral-rich land. And in addition, they have it with many of the stages of mining. Since the online free entry staking program came on board, the number of claims on their territory has exploded, and the report includes a map illustrating that. As I mentioned, they have many exploration sites in their territory, they have an open pit site on their territory, and they have abandoned mines, particularly a mercury mine from World War II on their territory. So they cover the gamut of issues.
Oh, and was it very easy to get them on board with your study?
They were very welcoming, and we appreciate their willingness to allow us to come up there and to interview not only chief and council, but many members of the band who in different positions or just ordinary citizens who rely on the land and have lived there for generations.
And the report concludes the need for legal reform, and can you explain that?
Yes, well, we'd like to see a better balancing of burdens and benefits. And we try to do this, for example, is to improve the consultation process. So the government, we believe, should start consultation at the beginning of the mining process, you know, so at the free entry stage, continue to consult and give more adequate time for First Nations response throughout the process. We also believe there should be more stringent environmental regulations that take into account not just environmental destruction, but the human rights implications of a particular project. It's worth that we also make recommendations to mining companies and to Tako Lake and First Nations themselves. The mining companies, we encourage them to voluntarily consult First Nations and to share some benefits of revenue and job opportunities. For the First Nations, we encourage them to determine more clearly what they want in terms of consultation, who in their band should be consulted. We encourage them to figure out how they want to receive benefits and to relay that information to government industries so they can better meet their needs.
That was Bonnie Dougherty, author of Harvard Law School's report on the effects of mining on First Nations in British Columbia. In BC, First Nation communities and municipalities have been quietly working together for nearly two decades. To date, there have been nearly 100 agreements signed between First Nations and towns on several different issues, including jurisdictional to relationship building to recognition of self-government and Aboriginal title. Those findings are according to Christopher Alcantara, a Wilfrid Laurier University researcher, and his co-author, University of Toronto postdoctoral candidate Jen Mells. Alcantara presented his research last week at the 2010 Congress for the Humanities and Social Sciences at Montreal's Concordia University. Here's Christopher Alcantara.
We're just starting a research project that looks at the relationship between First Nations and municipalities. No one's really looked at it, as far as we can tell. So we thought, let's have a look and see. First of all, are there relationships between First Nations and municipalities? And if so, what kind of relationships are there? And so that was the first step. And the second thing we'll do is to look at cooperation and non-cooperation. What are the factors that sort of facilitate that, and what are the outcomes? But our first thing was let's look at whether these relationships exist. And in British Columbia, we found that in terms of public available documents, we found 93 intergovernmental agreements between First Nation governments and municipal governments. And it was fascinating because, first of all, there were so many. That's from a period of about 1990 to 2009, so that there were a lot more than we thought there'd be. And that's just those are the only ones that are publicly available. So there could be dozens more. So that was one interesting thing. And the second interesting thing was the nature of the agreements. So most of the agreements in the beginning, the period we looked at, were mostly what we call jurisdictional agreements. And so they're basic types of agreements where first we'll enter into agreement with a municipality to provide fire protection services or garbage collection or snow removal. But the fascinating part of our research, this first project, was that these agreements were later being displaced. I mean, they're still being signed, but we have the emergence of what we call relationship-building agreements. And these agreements are basically the parties agree or announce to build more formal types of relationships with respect to areas of mutual interest. And the relationships are supposed to be, equal and respectful relationships. They also include things like agreeing to meet every once every year or several times a year or create new communication. Also, so you have relationship building agreements, but also what's really interesting for us is what we call decolonization agreements. So we found actually 11 of these types of agreements in which the municipal government recognizes things like Aboriginal title, Aboriginal rights, the fact that that Aboriginal groups will have lived in the area and are on their lands since time immemorial, sometimes the recognition of Aboriginal self. These for us were the most exciting parts of our findings, was finding these two agreements. And you contrast that to the types of relationships that are occurring between First Nations and the federal government, or First Nations and provincial territorial governments. And we thought this is really this is a good news story, we think.
I think so, too. And out of the 93 agreements that you found that were publicly available, like you said, how many, you concentrated your studies more in BC, but were these 93 agreements just in BC or were they coast to coast?
Yeah, these were just in BC because they were the only ones that were easily accessible and public. But we know that there are other agreements across Canada that are similar. So in Ontario, for instance, There are a number of agreements that are being that have been signed that are similar to what's going on in BC, and the provincial government and a number of Aboriginal organizations are promoting these types of agreements. We just don't have, you know, we haven't been able to collect the data yet on agreements in Ontario and elsewhere outside of BC. So we're hoping, as we pursue this project, we'll be able to do that.
Okay, and do you see the First Nation communities and the municipalities working together to support common fights or goals, such as the opposition to the Site C Dam project in Peace River?
No, but that's the case. But I do know that that there is the possibility that these agreements will lead to these type of municipal First Nation coalitions or alliances. So there's some of these agreements are creating what academics call multi-level governance, which is basically structures where First Nations and municipal governments agree to work together to manage something. So we have, for instance, in BC, there's an agreement that the municipal government and the First Nations agree to jointly manage a forest area that is adjacent to the two communities. So they're creating this council that will together govern this and work together. So we think, this is the second part of the project to look at this, but we think that these types of arrangements are going to lead to more alliance building. It just makes the more you cooperate, the more you have stronger ties with each other, the more likely you're to work together in other areas, maybe against the provincial government, maybe against the federal government, maybe with the provincial government, maybe with... But we think, in short, we think that these relationships will lead to this type of coalition and alliance building. We're not sure yet, but because the evidence we have is still in its infancy, but we think the possibility is high.
Well, that's really interesting. And then you were saying that there is 11 agreements that recognize self-government. And do you think that the province and maybe the feds, so that will set precedence for the province and the federal governments to perhaps recognize self-government and First Nation jurisdiction?
Probably not. Because municipal governments, they're not constitutional beings like the provinces or the federal government. The feds and the provinces can ignore what the municipalities say. So I don't think there may be some moral effect. You know, that here's a settler government. You know, a non-Aboriginal government recognizing Aboriginal title, Aboriginal rights, in some cases Aboriginal self-government. So there's a moral case to be made there. You know, this is on behalf or informing municipal citizens, and municipal citizens are also members of the federal government, are citizens of the federal government, territorial government. So it's possible that there may be some moral force, but there's no real legal force, and feds really could just simply, ignore. The feds don't have to follow this recognition. So there may be some marginal effect, but we don't think there's going to be a big effect on the federal and territorial governments.
That was Christopher Alcantara, a researcher with Wilfrid Laurier University. Now here's Wayne Valley with a Sacred Journey from his CD, Green Dress.
Let's all go down to the lodge, to the place a long time ago. We will swim, sweat, and sing and dance. I will help you build our tattered souls. Help our spirits guide the wounded heart. Let the sacred journey go.
Well, open our head, tongue. Sometimes it's hard to let me
undivided blame of someone out there we all know. My brothers and sisters stand next to me, telling me you're not alone.
Reconciliation Commission has been forging ahead with its work after some reorganization. Justice Murray Sinclair, chair of the commission, gives Bamsuda an update on the TRC.
When we were appointed as the new commissioners on July 1st of last year, we inherited an existing entity. We had staff in place in Ottawa and an office in Ottawa. And we decided as commissioners that because 70% of the survivors and 75% of the schools are in Western Canada, that it made more sense for us to have a Western Canadian location for our head office. So we moved our head office from Ottawa to Winnipeg, which we've now established since April the 8th was our house. But our operation has been here since the fall of last year. And we spent most of our time since our appointment responding to invitations from various communities to come and speak with the survivors in their communities. Altogether, since August the 1st of last year, we've attended approximately 200 different community events as commissioners, just meeting with survivors at the community level. We've been in and around the Sudbury area twice to attend community events there. We've been to an event at Spanish, for example. So the interest level at the communities with the survivors is very strong. And so we were targeting them to ensure that their initial request, which had been sitting waiting for the new commissioners to be appointed, were dealt with first. And now that we've dealt with those then, and we're now going to focus on organizing our community event strategy in a more cohesive manner.
Okay, and I was doing some reading, and I learned that the TRC also plans to build a residential school, museum, and library. And have you found a location for that yet?
The commitment that we've made, and it's a requirement under our mandate, is that we're going to build a national research center, or we're going to establish a national research center. Whether or not it's going to be a new building, I have my doubts, because I don't think we need necessarily to go into a bricks and mortar process. I think what we're looking for is whether there's an existing place where the national research center on Indian residential schools can be established. So right at this point in time, we're engaging in a process in which we're involving people who have expertise in this area dealing with such entities. whether they can come and advise us about the kind of entity that we should be looking for. And then at some point, we'll be issuing a request for proposals from institutions that are not contained within, so that we can establish an institution that will be independent and will service the needs both of the academic community in terms of research as well as public in terms of interest.
Okay, and the other thing is, I understand that there's a children's research project going on for the lost or unmarked graves, and what's going to happen at the end of that, and by the way, how is that going?
We have made a commitment to the survivors right at the beginning that we understood that one of the pressing questions that had to be addressed was the question of what happened to the thousands of children who never came back from the schools. We know that from the research that we gathered that there were several thousand children who died in the school, primarily from diseases, some from incidents involving other people. And so what we're trying to determine is whether or not those incidents are recorded, whether those deaths are properly recorded, and where those children were buried, and what's become of them, what has been done with the burial sites and the cemeteries. And whether or not there are some children who are missing whose disappearances have never been acknowledged in the material. So it's a significant research project. It's probably one of our most significant research initiatives here at the Commission. We expect that it'll take most of the term of the Commission for us to complete that. And starting off now, the end of work that's being done at this point in time is to identify the burial sites that have been attached to each of the residential schools, and to take what records exist for those cemeteries and burial sites, so that we can begin to compile those records.
That was Justice Murray Sinclair, chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The TRC will be hosting its first of six national events, June 16th to the 19th in Winnipeg. Last month, a delegation of Canadian Aboriginal curators attended the 17th Biennale of Sydney, Australia, where it has been reported that the largest contingent of Canadian artists were invited to exhibit their latest works. Assistant curator of the Mackenzie Art Gallery in Regina, Michelle Lavallee, was one of those delegates, and this was her second time attending the event, and also she made stops in New Zealand. She says much of the Indigenous art in those two countries have very similar themes to Indigenous people in Canada.
Well, part of our intent on going was to attend and simply observe the Biennale exhibition and events and their outreach programs. In addition, we would go around to the public programming events related to the Biennale, but also other artist-run centers and galleries in the surrounding areas, both in Sydney, outside of the city of Sydney, and our first stop was in New Zealand. So we visited three places in New Zealand and some art centers and cultural centers while we were there as well.
And what did you learn?
Well,
lots
I think
of stuff.
This, as I mentioned, this is my second time to Sydney. It was my first time to New Zealand. And some things that I was most pleased to learn about was the parallels between the histories and some of the work being produced by artists of Indigenous descent, both here and there. So there was definitely a lot of parallel, you know, obviously because of the shared histories of, you know, colonization and 60s scoop and reservation systems and all that type of history. One of the things that was most impressive, particularly in New Zealand, was how respected the Indigenous culture was in New Zealand and how there's always an active effort to acknowledge the presence of Indigenous people. I never went to an event, regardless if it was in an Aboriginal venue or a non-Aboriginal venue, where they did not acknowledge the people who were the original inhabitants of the land. In Australia, it's a little bit different. I don't think the recognition or respect for Aboriginal culture is as far ahead as it was in New Zealand, but there was still that effort in Australia at events, even, you know, particularly at the Biennale, to acknowledge the original people's lands who, you know, the events or the galleries were upon. So that's something that I really appreciated and was very happy to see, and that's something that we do here sometimes, but not enough, and that it is something I think that should be done all the time.
So Canadians have a lot to learn from the New Zealanders.
I think in some ways, yes, you know, in some ways I do think because of circumstances, our practice and acceptance of Aboriginal artists is a little bit further ahead, just because of racism and circumstance. However, that still exists here, and yes, most definitely, particularly from what I saw in New Zealand, we have some catching up to do.
And what kind of catching up do you mean?
Particularly, I think the way, referencing New Zealand, particularly the way Indigenous culture is integrated into everything that is done over there. Visibility of Aboriginal people everywhere I went, it was recognized, not just being, you know, Aboriginal people being a visible presence, but the respect and acknowledgement of the shared histories of, you know, many nations living in one place, whether it be the airports, whether it be, you know, just walking through malls or restaurants, the museums. There's definitely a lot more visibility of the shared history, of Indigenous history, and recognition of, you know, the original owners of the land and their struggles. A lot less in Australia, but, you know, definitely I'm interested in further implementing here. And, you know, that's a process I think we're heading towards, and I know there's a lot of us, particularly those in the delegation, but many more who were not part of the delegation, working in Canada towards, you know, similar goals.
So what struck you most about the artwork in New Zealand or Australia?
Well, I guess some of the things that really struck me through viewing a lot of the work, I'm not sure if you're referencing the particularly the Aboriginal artist or the non-Aboriginal art. With reference to the Aboriginal art, as I mentioned, there's a lot of similarities in the issues and the tactics being utilized by artists there that I see in artists of Indigenous descent here. As far as looking at the art in general, particularly being at a Biennale, I haven't had much experience at many Biennales. I have actually only been to the Sydney Biennales myself. But it is definitely a great overview of, you know, contemporary art, people who are active right now, and you know, some of the top artists that, you know, are coming from around the world. So it definitely was a good experience for me to get to know, you know, what's happening everywhere. And that enabled me to further look into artists and aspects and issues that, you know, I found of particular interest that I can bring back to the gallery and, you know, work on here.
That was Michelle LaValle, assistant curator at the Mackenzie Art Gallery in Regina. She was discussing her recent trip to the 17th Biennale of Sydney, Australia.
Looking for my ancestors, I heard they walk this way. There are no signs on the road less traveled, they must be here someplace. How do you mark a nomad's path? Trail a puff of smoke. I'm looking for my ancestors, I heard they walk this way. Way high up, way high up, way high up, way high up. I'm looking for my ancestors, I heard they walk this way. Musky buffalo. Will I find them in the churches or find them in the schools? I'm looking for my ancestors. I heard they lost their way. Way high up, way high up, way high up, way high up. I'm looking for my ancestors. I heard they lost their way. Where's the truth of those who came before me? What's mine? eager step or heard a fiddle play. I feel like I know this land. I feel like I've been here before. I think I found my ancestors. I know they dance this way.
Andrea Menard with Ancestors from her CD Simple Steps. Menard took home Best International Artist in last year's Aboriginal People's Choice Awards, which is heading into its fifth year now. The competition has been growing to include more categories and will include voting by industry professionals in the music biz this year, and the competition is out with a call for submissions. Derek McCorrister is the Manager of Operations for the Aboriginal People's Music Choice Awards.
Right now, we have started our call for submissions for 2010 for all artists. The deadline for artists' submissions is June 30th at 5 o'clock. We have to receive the submissions in the office here. Our offices are located in Winnipeg, Manitoba. We have a number of categories for artists to submit to on the industry and genre side as well.
Okay, well, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, we have this year we have a total of about 29 award categories we are going to be presenting out over the course of 2 days in November. The way the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards work is that there are two rounds of voting to nominate artists. The round of voting starts on July 14th at 11 o'clock in the morning Central Time. It's an online voting system. Anyone can sign up to cast their vote. Basically, they just have to go to the website, which is aboriginalpeopleschoice.com. Sign up to become an online member or an online voter. Once the voting round starts, accounts are activated, and anyone can go in and log in and see all the artists who submitted to various categories and cast their votes. We have a number of categories that artists can select from, everything from Entertainment of the Year to Single of the Year, genre categories, Best Rock. We've introduced a couple new categories this year as well for Francophone CD, International Indigenous Artist as well. So once the first round closes on August 18th, we'll then be able to tally up all the voting and the top 3 to 5 artists are in each of the categories. At that time, we'll determine our nominees. We'll make an announcement who the nominees are on August 25th, and that time the final round again, and the online members will be able to go in and select from those nominees who will ultimately be the winners, and we will present those awards out over the course of 2 nights here in Winnipeg. The first night awards are November 4th at the McPhillips Station. And, of course, the big live broadcast award show at the MTS Center here in downtown Winnipeg on November 5th.
And how are artist submissions eligible?
Well, we have a two-year eligibility period for the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. Any released project within the last 2 years, from June 30th of 2008 to June 30th of this year, of 2010, those projects are considered eligible for the awards. Now, the submission criteria, all of the official entry form is available on the website. It goes through the guidelines, the registration requirements for the awards, and then once you meet those, you send in your submission to us, and then we will screen it and track it and deem it eligible for the awards. So once we have a submission, the artists we create this profile on the website. So anyone anywhere can log onto the website and see all the artists who submitted to the awards and do a little. We usually take a little bio, some sample tracks of their project, the award categories that they submitted to, so on and so forth. So you get a little bit of background. You can sample some music, and then once you've done that, when the voting round opens, people can go in and actually cast their vote for their favorite artist.
Okay, and considering that this is the 5th annual Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards, do you find that the voting and the submissions are growing?
Yeah, we do. We have a number of submissions every year. We're averaging roughly around 125 per year. This year we are sitting at about 90, which we assume it's going to keep on growing. The word is getting out there. Yeah, we are relatively new. This is our 5th year. The awards have developed over the course of time. We've also introduced industry voting this year as well, too. So industry professionals are logging in and casting their vote in some of the industry categories. And, of course, the general public is voting in all the other categories as well. So it ultimately, you know, it's going into a good direction. And, you know, we're always looking for new ideas. We have a feedback form on our website as well, too. From the people, since this is a People's Choice Music Award.
That was Derek McCorrister, Manager of Operations for the Aboriginal People's Music Choice Awards. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. Thanks for listening to Bombsida.